What's going on? It's your boy Tyrell Deshawn, the R&B sensation from Pure Brands ENT, and you are now rocking with Miss Robin Lynn on Vibes Live Radio. Keep the vibes live, you dig?
Hello, I'm Robin Lynn Maven, the CEO, creator, and producer of Vibes Live. We have over 2 million geographical listeners reaching 200 countries with nonstop music 24/7. Just tune in on VibesLive.com. I say the hip hop, you just don't stop it, and just get ready to jam. The Disco Daddy Wide World of Hip Hop Radio Show, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, only on VibesLive.com, with special guests every week. Don't miss it.
Hello out there, Disco Daddy here. Welcome to Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. And as you know, our show, we've been having historic interviews with icons and legends of hip hop. From their own words, from their own mouth, we have an iconic, legendary figure as a guest in our show today, Kool Pyle, the original Star Child out of New York City. And he has one of the most interesting stories in hip-hop because his career spans from before records, when records started being made, and the brother is still active. We're going to let him tell us about his career and about the early days of hip-hop and how he got involved. And he's on the other line now. Kool Pyle, original Star Child, are you there?
Yes, sir, Michael Disco Daddy. What up, what up?
Thank you. It's going well. I'm not going to explain to the audience all the things that have gone on today, but it's one of those days when everything goes wrong. But, you know, when you're trying to do something right. So I make my apologies to you, brother, and you're a soldier because you roll with me, and I like that. So we're going to get into
it. It's all about Disco Daddy. You know that.
No, thank you. It's about hip-hop, and you know, you're a true story, and we're also going to touch on the true stories and what that's about, because very few people outside of New York and outside the hip-hop circles that we live in know exactly what a true story is, and its place, and what we do as far as hip-hop history is concerned, whether it's East Coast or West Coast hip-hop. So, Kool Pyle, the original Star Child, tell us about yourself.
Well, I mean, basically, man, I come from the South Bronx, really the Bronx, New York, New York City. And I came up during the days, the mid-70s, I was a teenager. And there was a movement going on in New York at that time, music-wise, amongst the youth in New York, really. The urban youth, and urban is a slash word for black and Hispanic, people of color.
Right.
Yeah, New York was going through a time back then when there was very little for urban youth to do after school, weekends. It's just that the city had cut down
after
school.
What years was this turmoil going on that emerged up?
Okay, we're talking about the mid-70s, early to mid-70s, 73, 74. I was a teenager in the early teen, 13, 14, 15. And basically, you know, that New York was going through a period where the money was really, really, really low. And to the average person, you might think, well, what does that have to do with you? But basically what happened was, you know, when you were in junior high school, public school and junior high school, they were after school programs. You know, you could go play basketball, gymnastics, hang out with your friends. You know, you had something to do after school, and especially after school in the nighttime. Right, T.A.L.
Right.
But these things were getting cut left and right because New York was running out of money. And there was basically nothing. By 1974 and 5, four, five, six, maybe four and five. New York was really, really bad. You know, there was a mass exodus by landlords in the South Bronx. They were burning their buildings down to collect insurance. The Bronx rapidly was turning into a ghetto. Like, overnight, buildings were burning. You could take the subway train through the Bronx. It would look like Iran and Iraq looks like now. Yeah. And you wouldn't believe you were in New York. I mean, just burnt blocks and blocks and blocks and blocks of burned out buildings before you got to a train station, get off, walk through these blocks, and there would be places where people lived, of course. But, you know, the majority of the area was, like, really torn down and bad. Also, at that time, there was the emergence of the gangs in New York. We had gang culture. Mm-hmm. Various gangs, Savage Skulls, Black Spades, The Bachelors, Seven Immortals. These are the original gangs in New York City. Peacemakers. Okay. These gang activities for youth. And either you were in a gang or you got inducted into a gang. When I mean inducted, they jumped you into a gang. You could be in a park playing basketball or handball or whatever you were doing in the park, and they would have an induction. And they would come to the park wearing their colors and just look at you, grab you, beat you up, and tell you, you're in a gang now. Take your sneakers. you walk home barefooted or in socks.
Just like that.
If they like your socks, they take your socks too. But I'm saying, you know, now you're jumped into a gang.
Right.
Some kids really weren't into that. They didn't really want to fight. They weren't trying to be in a gang. And there were some kids who were looking for something to do and wanted to belong to something. And a lot of kids came from homes where there was no dad or the money was really low and they were really disadvantaged. They didn't realize they were disadvantaged, but they were. And the combination of all this left a big hole in urban youth at that time. Having said all that, there was also the emergence of a music scene coming up. Now, we didn't realize it was a music scene because previously to hip-hop coming about, and this is before we even called hip-hop, there were bands, R&B and rock bands, really R&B in urban areas in South Bronx and Harlem. They would come to the parks and play music, you know, bass, drums, guitar, horns, regular bands. And they'd play the popular records that you heard. They'd play their own original music. This was on the weekends, Saturdays, Sundays, maybe Friday nights. And we would go see these bands. Now, as the bands were playing, there would be a DJ. And the DJ, he would play between the bands, and maybe sometimes the band wouldn't show up, but this DJ would come out. He would come out with a turntable.
Right.
And he'd play the same popular records, but the real records. And, you know, the kids would gather and listen to that and dance and stuff and make noise and hang out. It was something to do. That started to become popular.
This is one turntable. There was no mixers at this time.
No, there was no mixers. There was a microphone because the DJ had to tell the people, like, we're shutting down at 5 o'clock or we're shutting down and just to make announcements. There was no rapping, no rhyming, no scheme to any of this.
Okay.
Someone decided to bring two turntables. Now, there's a big, big discussion in New York about how that really, 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 really started and what borough it started in. But I can say, from my experience, around 74, Kool Herc decides to give a party in the building he lived in and that, for his sister, Cindy. It was a back-to-school party. She was trying to get money to do her own little thing, I think back-to-school shopping or something she wanted money for. So she decides to give a party. She gets a bigger brother, Kool Herc, to DJ. Now, Kool Herc's father was a sound engineer. He had something to do with musical equipment, so he had equipment. He puts these two turntables together and a mixer. That's to blend one turntable into the next turntable to make the music continuous. Previously to that, the song would go to the end. You'd wait a couple of seconds. The next record would come on, as we all know.
Right.
But this is continuing the music, so there's no break in between the music. You'd be dancing, then the next song would come on. Now, whether it was mixed on time or not didn't really bother. You didn't concern yourself with that. It's just there was no break. So you didn't have to go off the dance floor, ask a girl to dance again or do whatever you did. You stayed on the dance floor. And as long as the tempo was correct, you didn't mind. You danced. You kept dancing.
Right.
So Kool Herc does this. A lot of us consider that the first hip-hop party because what he did was he concentrated on the funk. Herc was a Jamaican who came from Jamaica, moved to Jamaica a few years previously. He got exposed to the toasting style, which the Jamaican DJs did. They said things on the mic, and they concentrated on the reggae beat. Reggae has a lot of funk in it, and it's really bass-driven, as you well know, Disco Daddy. You know, you're a music guy, you know. So basically, Herc plays these records, but he's concentrating on James Brown. He's concentrating on the breakbeats. He's concentrating on the part of the record that we call the get-down part. Before it was called the break part, we called it the get-down part. The part where you would wait for the drums to come in the bass line, you would get down. That's the part we really got funky with the dance steps.
Right.
So he's doing this. Other DJs, I don't know how they saw him do this, but maybe there was something in the air around that time because DJs started popping up and they were all, you know, like two turntables. And then, you know, like you're going to this party and that party. And some cool Herc is playing here now. And then DJ Jones, who was around almost the same time, and maybe even previously, but he was more an R&B, an older guy, but now he's playing certain songs that we'd like to hear. You're going to the DJ Jones party, and now you're going to that one's party, and you're going to this one's party. And with the combination of these funky breaks coming along, now mind you, we're 13, 14, 15 years old. We're young dudes.
Right.
We like to dance. When I say dance, whatever popular dance was out that you learned in school and practiced at home, and you didn't see it on Soul Train because Soul Train was doing California dancing. At that time, Soul Train was still based in Chicago, but then pretty soon it moved to California. And these dancers were coming out of L.A. We didn't dance like that in Soul Train. We did those dances because we saw them on TV, but we had our own dances in New York, and we were making them dances. So these dances, we would take to these parties, and then we would do them at these parties, and a lot of us, the guys, would practice these moves, but they were like fly moves. Like we try to spin around like James Brown, and then we'd stop and pose, and then we'd go around behind the girl and touch her face, and she'd turn around. We weren't there anymore. And then we'd do something to the top of her head, and then we'd split and come slide back up and do something funky with our body. We called it burning.
And that preceded full-blown what we now call breakdancing. It was called
burning. Yes, that preceded it. It was called burning.
Okay.
And what we would do with our friends is like, yo, let's go to this party. But before we went to the party, maybe during the week a couple of times, we'd practice together. Everybody had a crew. You weren't rolling alone because the Bronx in those days, and you would go to different neighborhoods, you had to go, you couldn't go alone. You had to go deep. When I say deep, at least 5, 6 of your own guys that knew you, that could protect you if stuff jumped off, because more than likely, outside the party, maybe during the party, before the party, after the party, on your way home, on the subway train, walking on your own block, stuff was jumping off in those days. Okay?
Man.
That's how it was in the Bronx in those days. So you roll with your crew, but you practiced with your crew. So now you had choreographed moves that you knew when you went to that party at a certain point in that record, and you knew Herc was going to play this record, Give It Up, Turn It Loose by James Brown, Samandi by Broad with that long bass line, anything with a funky beat on it. But he would play it before the beat, maybe into the beat, so you'd lay for that. So now you're regular dancing, and you get a girl. She asks her friends to. Now you're lined up against these girls. They have no idea this is coming. So the break will come on, and you look at your boys, and you say, ready, and they go, ready. And the break will come on, and all of a sudden we're doing these moves like the Temptations on steroids, and you would just burn them. They would be like, oh, what are y'all doing? They're looking in your face, but now you're at their feet, and you're spinning around, and you pop back up, and now you're doing a little bit of the robot, kind of the robot, before the robot, not a real robot, but kind of stiffening. You freeze, and then you move away, you jump back in her, and then you spin her body around. She's like, why are you touching me? You're spinning her around. You make her stop. You touch her head. You take your own hat off, put it on her head, take it off, and all kind of stuff, and we started doing that.
Wow.
As we were doing that,
let me ask you, pause you right there. Are there any films have you seen any films, you know, these have those little Super 8 cameras people carry. Have you seen any?
I've actually never seen a whole movie of that stuff because that was very early. We're talking about 73, 4, and 5.
I got you, right.
And it would be excellent to see because all of us did it. And as it spread, the Bronx was doing it, Harlem was doing it. I'm a Bronx guy, but I went to high school in Harlem. Around this time, I'm in high school now, 74, 5. I go to high school, I meet a guy named Curtis Blow. Blow was a dancer, too, from Harlem. This is way before he's rapping and rhyming, but he's dancing.
Right.
So he's beat. Now we're called B-boys, burn boys and break boys, because we dance at the break of the music. That's what the break really means, at the break of the music. So he's doing it, I'm doing it. There was another guy who wound up being a very big free writer. His name was Butch, too. Butch did it. We had a guy in high school named Rubberneck, Kevin Baskerville, he did it. His name was Rubberneck because of the way he used to bend his neck. His body would be turning one way, his head would follow like 2 seconds later, and we named him Rubberneck. And then every hood had their own group of dancers. So now we go to high school to high school and challenge the next group of guys that we heard about. You had Sally Rock, who went to the High School of Science. He's a Zulu king, and Sally was like a fabulous b-boy. You had Fuji Lalonde, who was on Facebook. Yeah. Sally Rock.
Sally Rock is on this show with you, my brother. He's got the other half tonight. We got him last week, so this is going to be really nice. Go ahead, my brother.
Very good. So Sally Rock was
The original star child on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. Continue, my brother.
Sally Rock was an original Zulu king. So Charlie's hanging out in Bounce River with the Zulu guys and their B-boys, and they're doing their thing. I'm uptown. Charlie is from uptown, but he was hanging down in Bounce River. This is before Bambada is now just starting to play records, so they're dancing to Bambada's music. And there's
this is
no
76, 76, 77.
This is 75 going on 76 now.
Bambada's
76 merging it to 77. But by the time 76, 77 came, now we're getting a little bit older. We're not getting on the floor anymore because now we're getting a little bit older, and you know we're wearing nice clothes, and these clothes cost money. We're not trying to get dusty, and we're not trying to get dirty. And instead of burning these girls, we want to talk to these girls. Now we're getting reputations for being dancers, but we're noticing what's going on with the music. Now, Kool Herc is a guy that talks on his microphone who is also a DJ. His name is Coke LaRock. Coke is making announcements, but as he's making announcements, he's putting words that rhyme together. He's telling the crowd, like, you know, right about now to the, we're going to get down. Take you all the way to the last stop, stop, stop. He's making an echo with his mouth. Last stop, 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 stop. You listen to the fabulous sounds of the DJ they call Kool Herc, and I am the Coke LaRock, the nonstop make your body rock. And he's doing things with his rhymes and his voice that are in syncopation with the music. So you're hearing this now, and that in combination with the beats of the music is combining into something that's different than just DJing, and we pick up on that. Meanwhile, in New York City, on the furthest end of the AM dial was the only black station. This is before WBLS invented contemporary urban music. They invented that program. Yes, sir, WWRL. WWRL had a plethora of black DJs. Hank Spann, Jerry Bledsoe, Frankie Crocker before he became the program director at BLS. And all these guys had these baritone voices. And when they announced the record, they wouldn't just put the record on. They'd say, and right about now, with that number one smash hit, getting ready to make you move your body, make you real oogie, Kool & the Gang with Jungle Boogie. Get down, and they would announce the record, but a rhyme before the record. And when the record ended, they'd rhyme after the record. So now they're doing this, we hear these voices, and I remember clearly me and Curtis Blow, like in high school, you know, we're imitating these radio jocks. Yeah, my name is Cool Cal, trying to sound like Hank Spann. Get down, my man. And then Kurt's doing it.
So,
and then
the early predecessing to rap evolved in from what you're talking about now, trying to have the professional DJ voice on the microphone.
Yes.
And that was even preceded the guys, I know you're going to touch on the nursery rhyme phase and everything like that, but all of this preceded that. And I want to tell the audience, Frankie Crocker and WWRL Radio. See, I was 1965, 66, 67, at the height of the big RL, Kool Cal.
Yes,
and
sir.
At 7 o'clock, the streets of Harlem and just about every other black community were clear just because at 7 o'clock, the opening to the Frankie Crocker Show, there are 8 acknowledged wonders of the world you are about to listen to. And then that jazz tune that he had, a young man who's become a legend in his own time. It's the Frankie Crocker Show. And I remember the influence he had on me. When I moved to L.A. and I auditioned for my first disco job in 76, I had grown up in New York. And just like you just said, a DJ rhymed. You know what I'm saying? A DJ never just stood and played records. I never even had a concept like that. So I made up little rhymes. with no nothing elaborate, little rhymes. I'm glad to see your face in the place. Welcome to the showcase. That was the name of the club. And the guy hired me because I was just a little different. But that's right. How Disco Daddy began. The influence of Frankie Cocker and Jocko, Hank Spann, people
Jocko,
like that.
Right, out of Philly, right. Hank Spann was a big influence too, right. They all had that voice. And see, simultaneously while he was doing that, there was, and right now there is a guy, his name is DJ Hollywood. Hollywood had been playing simultaneously with Cool Herc, but Hollywood wasn't just concentrating on beats like Herc was, and Hollywood could really, really DJ. Never missed a beat, but he played popular records that you heard on the radio, and he didn't really delve into the obscure beats like Herc did, but he played what was popular, but while he played records, he rhymed too, and he did it a little bit different than Coke. See, Coke would say sentences, maybe half a paragraph, it's that much, but Coke wasn't really trying to do that. That's just what his style was. But see, what Hollywood did, Hollywood would write things and remember them and say them in syncopation directly to the beat. And he had this style. My name is Hollywood, and I'll make it good, get down right about now. He stretch it out, and you listen to the funkiest sound of Hollywood, and I'm going to make you get down. And he'd do that thing with his voice. It was the radio voice with his voice. And he would put them to specific records that had specific areas in the record that just matched to it perfectly. And he did this thing off of Love Is the Message, which was like, it was like butter on top of mashed potatoes, man. It was perfect. And he was doing that. So while he's doing that now, you can see that this is something to be done. My awakening, I'd already been aware of this now, mind you, okay? I'm 16 now, and I'm knowing. I'm not breakdancing anymore. I'm not burning girls. I got the voice, and I want to be on the radio. My first intention was to be on the radio. I've always had a nice voice, and plus I can sing. But that wasn't, you know, I started to be an R&B group. I had an excellent falsetto. Anything Phil Bailey could do, I could do. I had an excellent falsetto, and I had a great tenor. But that really, and I went to the High School of Music and Art with Curtis Blow, mind you. I forgot to mention the school. That's the school they made the movie Fame from. A lot of famous musicians came out of there. From my era that you see now playing right now, Marcus Miller, number one studio bass player in America. I went to high school with Marcus. Yes, he was playing clarinet. He used to bring his bass in a case and play on the side. I went to high school. He was in a lot of my classes, Marcus. I can go on and on with the names. But I noticed that, you know, though, this thing with the music. So I wanted to DJ and talk. And not too many guys were doing that yet. Hollywood was doing it. Lovebug Starsky is another one who was doing it, but Starsky was a little bit more street than Hollywood. He played more of the beats, but he concentrated on the popular records, but he had that street style, but he still talked like, I'm L-O-V-E to B-U-G, and he was cool, though, but he rocked it. So my thing was, I heard him one night, cool. He blew my mind a little bit, and I was like, yo, Starsky, man, this cat Starsky, this is in 76. But long story short, I met this girl. This girl's best friend was Hollywood's girlfriend at the time. So I'm home writing these words off of Love Is the Message. I'm playing the record in my house, and, you know, I'm supposed to be dealing with her, and she's bored. And I'm like, yo, chill. Let me just finish doing this. What are you doing? I'm writing rhymes. She's like, rhyme? What are rhymes? So I'm reading what I'm writing. She goes, you know who does that a lot? It's really, really good. I'm like, yeah, who? DJ Hollywood. I say, oh, Hollywood? Yeah. That's Faye. Faye was Hollywood's girlfriend at the time. That's Faye's boyfriend. I said, really? She said, I'll call him right now. I couldn't believe it. She got on the phone, called Hollywood. Put him on the phone. Yeah, my man, what can I do for you? Yeah, what's up? Like, I was bothering him. But long story short, he hooked it up for me to go to 371, which is the club he was playing in on the regular. 371 in the Bronx was the mecca of young adult party. There was no b-boying in there. You couldn't wear sneakers. And that was another thing. See, the b-boys, we could wear sneakers to parties. Because we couldn't wear sneakers in clubs because we were too young to get in clubs. And we did our thing. They didn't want us spinning around on the floor and wearing sneakers and hats. they wanted young adults 25, anything over 18 where you had to have ID and you had to wear shoes. We weren't wearing shoes yet. But now I'm at the age now, I'm 18 now, 17 going, well, actually 18, and I'm trying to be fly, you know. And I'm talking to the older girls. And I want the girls that got a little something in their pocket and look a little something, something, you know what I'm saying? So, and then I want to do this DJ thing. Long story short, again, he invites us to 371. We go there that night. And when I walked through the door, I couldn't believe what I saw and heard. First of all, he exceeded the fire code five times over. You couldn't even stick your elbow out to scratch your behind if you wanted to. That's how many people were in there. And I'm looking around, and I hear this voice and the music, and I was mesmerized from the point when I walked in the door. This guy was singing words over the music, and whatever he told the crowd to do, the crowd did. And when I say the crowd, I mean the barmaids, the napkins, the glasses, the roaches that were hiding behind the counter, the mice that were in the wall, everything in there did what that man told them to do. And then at one point he said, "Who makes it good?" And everything in there said, "Hollywood." And I was like, "Oh my God, this is amazing. This is amazing." And mind you, this is 76 now. This is 76. So we make our way to the DJ, but I just want to shake his hand because I'm amazed. Because I had already heard about him. So he turns the music off. He's not even DJing. He's on the mic. Junebug, God bless the dead, who also DJed with him there. He taught him how to DJ. He tells Junebug, he announces to the crowd, this is prime time. This is 12 o'clock at night on a Saturday night. Everybody there to see Hollywood. There ain't nobody there to do nothing else but drink and see Hollywood. He now tells the crowd, "Yo, I got this dude want to get on my microphone. I want to give him some love. His name is Cool Kyle, a star child." So they all stop there like soldiers. They all face front attention, and they're facing the DJ booth. So I look out, and I go, "Oh, my God, what is this dude doing?" I didn't want to rock the mic. I had never performed in front of any no crowds. I mean, I did a couple of backyards, a couple of little driveways, my living room, my girl's living room, her family. I never performed in a club before. And this, I went from started from the bottom. Now I'm here. Yeah, Drake. Well, I started from the bottom, and I was there. And I went to Hollywood's home, and he gave me the mic, and Junebug put on a Sheik song, and I happened to have a rhyme over Sheik, and it was dance, dun, 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 dance, 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 no, it was before that, because it was early in there. Anyway, he put a record on, and I rocked.
Right.
He put something else on, and I rocked that. Then he put on a B-boy break. It was Apache, and I tore Apache up. He put on Love is the Message. And Love is the Message was Hollywood's theme then. And I had this thing that I had wrote off of Love is the Message. I kind of, I didn't steal from Hollywood, but he was an influence. I had heard of him. I knew how he got down, so I had my own little thing. I'm the K to the Y, the L and the E, and I rock your body fine. The K-Y-L-E, rock real good, you know I'll blow your mind. And then I went into my thing, and I rocked him, and I rocked him well. So let me stand there, got his arms folded, he bobbing his head, looking at me. He told Jim, okay, he did it. So, you know, and I thanked him for that because he let me get on his mic. And from that point on, like me and Woodward on the phone the other day talking about that, and he remembers it really well. And then when I got my own spot later on, I invited him to do the grand reopening. And, you know, he did his thing, I did my thing. That was years later. But anyway, that's when I started. Now,
Wait, before you fast forward. You were rapping. Now, Melly Mel.
I was just getting ready to go into that.
Well, I'm going to know, basically, were they active? I'm talking about, I think, Melly Mel and Raheem and Flash. I don't know, what was it, the three MCs?
Well, I'll get into that.
I just wanted to get the time reference because you were rapping here with Hollywood. So that must have been
76 going on 77.
There were people writing raps, and I'm just trying to get where you fit in with the timeline. So supposedly, Melly Mel is, according to Kid Creole, the first time he heard a written rap was when he saw Melly Mel do the thing from the World Trade Center to the depths of hell. Yes, that's the first written rhyme that he heard. It doesn't mean it was the first written rhyme. But he was talking about the period when they went from doing the nursery rhyme things and the DJ voice thing that you were just talking about into
right.
a period. So where did the written rhymes, who do you think, besides yourself, was at the forefront of actually writing the first original rhyme as we know it today?
Okay, as you know today is not what it was then. What you know today is a conglomeration. It's a hybrid of what Mel, his brother Creole, and the Furious did as a group, and what
okay.
Hollywood, Starsky, and those guys did as individuals. I am one of the first to combine the styles. It's a fact.
Right.
It's in concrete. This is how it happened, from my recollection. Around 77, Melly Mel, who's also a B-boy, he was a dancer.
Right.
Grandmaster
right.
Flash was a B-boy. Before he ever touched turntables, he was a dancer. He was a B-boy.
Okay.
Flash
wow.
starts DJing, okay? The
mm-hmm.
story about him DJing is a whole long, that would take another hour. But anyway, he moves
okay.
on from dancing to DJing. He's playing in the park.
Mm-hmm.
Mel, who was dancing for Flash at Flash's parties in the park, 23 Park, in the Bronx,
mm-hmm.
was watching
mm-hmm.
what Flash is doing. Now, Flash meets a guy named Keith Cowboy. Cowboy was actually Flash's first MC. And Cowboy is talking on the mic, but he's doing what Coco's doing, but he's putting more into it. He's doing sentences now, and the sentences are long sentences, and they're actually
wow.
coordinated like he actually wrote it, and maybe he did. And they could have been
right.
off the top of the dome. They could have been freestyle. I don't know. I can't tell
right.
you that. But they were coordinated to the point where you paid attention. And Mel's watching
mm-hmm.
Cowboy, and he goes, yo, I can do that too, because, you know, Mel obviously was a smart dude. Mel goes home, and he knows Cowboy. He met Cowboy. They were cool. He goes
right.
home and writes something. He goes back. He talks to Mel and Cowboy, and Mel and Cowboy become a little thing where Mel gets on the mic. Now they're saying things back and forth, kind of, but not practiced yet, together.
Right.
That's the
yeah.
beginning of the MC style. What happened was Mel had written something. This is in 77.
Right.
They're not an official group yet. There's only two of them. It's Cowboy
okay.
and Mel. What happened is Creole sees his brother write these rhymes. Creole
mm-hmm.
is following his brother to these parties. Creole wants to rhyme too. So Creole sits down in his room. He writes something. He reads it to Mel. They feed off each other. Now they go, well, let's write something together. So now
wow.
they're writing an organized thing together where it's two MCs, and they create the term E-M-C-E-E MCs. They create that term. So they bring
wow.
that to Cowboy. Now it's the three of them. So now they give it Flash, oh, let's be a little thing. Flash agrees. It was originally Cowboy. Mel came in. His brother joined very quickly after that. And now because Creole and Mel have an organized thing, which are basically the beginnings of routines. That's
okay.
the yes, yes, y'all period, which became the format that every group followed to this day. And what happened
yeah.
was the individual style of Hollywood, Eddie Cheeba, Lovebug Starsky, myself, was a little bit different because it was more of an adult thing. We talked like that. We had the
yeah.
baritone of the microphone. Mel has
right.
a baritone voice too. And if you hear old tapes, especially tapes of when, because I was down with them for quite a while. Myself, Curtis Blow was down. We were one big organization. And you can hear tapes
wow.
where I sound like Mel. Mel sounds like me. I just had a little bit more of that. But you can hear Mel and me sound alike. But what
right.
Mel did was as he said his rhymes, he would write something, and then they would go one, two, one more is three. Creole. Know what you got for me. He's leading to the next MC. When you're alone,
okay.
you don't have to do that. But that was the
right.
pattern they used. Creole invented
right.
the break in between rhymes, because when you were thinking about what your next rhyme going to be, he would say, yes, yes, y'all, to the beach, y'all. Freak, the freak dancers out there. Yes, yes, y'all, to the beach, y'all. Freak,
okay.
y'all. You don't
right.
stop. That was him preparing his mind for his next rhyme. It was a
That's
perfect
right.
bridge. He used the word freak, because the freak dance was out at that time.
Yeah.
And then that became the standard stanza or break or bridge that MCs would use, again, to this very day. So they combined
wow.
all that to the original MC group pattern, which was a little bit different. than the individual DJ who was rocking on the microphone. And at that time, it was significantly different.
Mostly group back then at that particular time.
They all did it. They all did it. And, the Furious Five, the three MCs, which became the four MCs, because Mr. Ness, who was a very good friend of Melly Mel, joined up. He was a dancer, too. Now they changed their name to the Furious Four MCs, and they practice now. Now they're writing routines together, practicing on the side. They get with Flash, and now they're having organized practices with Flash. Flash is DJing. He's putting on certain records they want to rhyme to, and they're practicing. Mm-hmm. They're writing things to these records. They know when the record's going to stop. Flash makes it stop when they want it to stop. Flash gives them intros. They have outros. They do all the music stuff like a group would do, but they're all rhymes. And they were a younger set than these older DJs. They were B-boys that turned into MCs, and they were younger. They were still wearing sneakers. I was in between. When I met Flash, the Furious history was notorious for Flash, because Mel and Flash a lot of times didn't get along. And Flash became very big practically overnight, and he was getting a lot of shows. And Flash couldn't get Mel because Mel was, like, on strike. Nah, man, he would break out, and he would take the MCs with him. So when Flash needed an MC, his manager would call me. And he would call Curtis Blow. So me and Curtis Blow, a lot of times, would substitute for the Furious Five just to do show Furious Four, then the Five, because then Raheem got down later on. But then there's Flyers with, it was called Black Door Productions. Ray Chandler was the manager. The whole group was called Black Door Productions. It was Grandmaster Flash. Disco B was the other DJ. Easy Mike was the other DJ. We had three DJs. I often rocked the mic for Disco B and Michael Really B, and I also rocked the mic for Flash, and it was Cool Cal and Curtis Blow and the Furious Five MCs. But a lot of times when Mel was on strike and Mel was mad at Flash, he wouldn't come. He wouldn't show up. He wouldn't, he was trying to show Flash something. They were arguing. So I would get on the mic, and I have a history with them. I could fit in with them because I still wasn't as old as Hollywood, but I wasn't as young as them. I'm Flash's age, which is a couple years older than them. But I still sounded like this a little bit. And if you'll cow sound too disco. No, but I did that because I wanted the older women. My appeal was to the girls. And as my style got into them, I noticed, I'm not saying I influenced any of them, because Cowboy always talks to the crowd. He's one of the first people to address what you had on, how much money was in your pocket. But they started, beside rhyming, addressing your party situation. How do y'all feel? Make some noise. How much money you got in your pocket? My whole thing was all the ladies in the house say, ow, say, cow. All that was, I was doing that too. I brought that kind of to them a little bit, but they were doing it also. So it was, the whole thing became a hybrid after a while, because as you got older, you wanted to be in the clubs. The clubs is where the money was at. And all this was before records. Once you made a record, you didn't care about that anymore because you were getting paid to perform your record. But all of this was before the first rap record. When the first, when the rap records came out, the whole thing became one big thing, because all the MCs that were in groups were trying to make records, and if they had a record that people wanted to hear, they were getting work. The DJs that made rap records, they got work. And it didn't matter what you really sounded like as long as you could do that record. But the beginnings were very separated in the beginning, because some guys were considered disco MCs and some were considered B-boy MCs, which Flash and them were in the very beginning. When Flash and I first walked into Disco Fever, which today is considered the mecca, one of the meccas of hip-hop, we were told, Flash and myself, one of those days when Mel was on strike, Flash and I are hanging out, just me and him, we go to the Phoenix, we have nothing better to do, and to make a long story short, we were told, Flash, you'll never DJ here because you're a B-boy DJ, and Kyle, you'll never rock the mic here because you're a B-boy MC, which was the furthest thing from the truth. A year later, Flash's name was on the wall, home of Grandmaster Flash, Disco B, and home of Cool Kyle, the Star Child, Curtis Blow, Sugar Hill Gang. They adopted all of us. So the whole thing got combined together.
Okay. Now, let me ask you, we interviewed Vizzy B. Starsky, and one of the revelations that he laid down, because I asked him about the famous battle with him and Kool Moe Dee, supposedly in December 1981, that people post a lot. And he, one of the revelations, he said there was no battle between me and Kool Moe Dee. Kool Moe Dee was on stage. He said, I was downstairs, and from what I understand, he was saying things like, you know, y'all know Busy B likes to do this like this, and blah, blah, blah. And he said, by the time I got upstairs, somebody came out and told me, he just mentioned my name. He said, by the time I got upstairs, it was over. But there was no battle. He said that was an MC convention with MCs invited from all over. And he
yes.
said the actual first battle between him and Kool Moe Dee was at the Disco Fever in 1982. And he really blew that myth out of the water that there was a battle. Now, that took place at, I forgot the ballroom in 1981, but it was December. It was an MC convention. He clarified that. Do you remember any battles before Disco Fever? They don't have to be famous names, but was battling an MC, another MC. Where do you remember that coming? Because all the Yes, Yes, Y'all and all of that, the things we identify with hip-hop, that's very, very interesting to know that that came out of one particular section of the Bronx and one small group of people, which later became Grandmaster Flash and yourself. But what about the battling?
Well, this is the deal. The battles were a natural outgrowth of the groups becoming very competitive. Young black men, and you have to understand something about hip-hop. Hip-hop was about who was the best in what neighborhood, because this was a territorial thing in the beginning. Even though a lot of the groups were all born and raised in the same neighborhoods, within blocks of each other, there were so many at a certain point where you had to stand out. Eventually, there were groups of more than one member. You had groups that had at least three members. Most of them had five at a certain point. And they all had great reputations and great names. So in order for the promoters to get the most that they could out of a particular venue to hype the crowd up, they invented that battle thing. The promoters were the ones that said, well, how would it be if Cold Crush battled with Fantastic? These guys went to school together. They hung out together. Had the same girlfriends a lot of the time. Okay, there was natural beef, but it wasn't kill each other beef. It was like, oh, man, please. We'll see.
Right.
We'll see. My tape is better than your tape. It was no really, really strong animosity. The promoters really put all that together. There was a world-famous battle between the Cold Crush and the Fantastic. Those were real battles on the microphone.
What year? Do you remember year that happened?
81, 82, 83. 80.
Okay.
Anywhere from 80 to like 83, they had some real stand on stage first and then come on second. Prize money was involved. They had battles. Cold Crush.
Right. Battling wasn't what we've come to see from the 8 Mile movie where you're dissing the other opponent. The early battles.
No, absolutely not. It was none of that standing next to each other, spitting each other's faces, dissing each other's clothes and mothers and all that. Because these guys from the Bronx, listen, as much as I know you, you're not talking about my mom because you're getting punched in the face and we're going to fight.
right
then and there. I mean, that's how it was back,
back
in those days.
So basically,
we could be boys.
Basically, when you battled then, basically you were just spitting your best lines and talking about the sucker MCs and this and that.
Exactly.
But you
what happens, you had a certain time to come on stage. You would get announced, and the flyer would say, Cold Crush versus Fantastic, top prize, $500. Cold Crush will come on first, or Fantastic will come on first, do their thing. Then the next group will come on, do their thing. They might come back again a second time, do their thing, and then the crowd would vote. And whatever the crowd yelled at, if the promoters didn't have their own stake in it to make it crooked, then you would find out who the winner is.
That's
how those battles were back in those days.
Okay.
We're not just standing next to each other. You know, your breath is stink. Your man's funky.
Yeah.
Your mother has sex like
a
retarded monkey. None of that nonsense. But they wasn't doing that back in those days. It wasn't like that.
Did you ever battle? Did you ever participate in the battle yourself?
No. Not like that. No. What usually happened with me was, we'd be together, and the mic would go like from the next guy to the next guy, and it wound up being like a battle, but it wasn't an official battle. It was announced to be a battle. It was just that, okay, you just said what you said. I got the mic now. I heard what you said. You was hot, but check this out. I'm hot too, and then we would do our things. But it was friendly, competitive. It was just to prove to you. When you see me, you better understand something. Don't sleep with me, because if the bottom line is, you know, you were trying to get work. You were trying to be on these flyers. You were trying to get paid. And you want the crowd to know, yo, that cat Cool Cow, or that cat Busy B, or this cat Melly Mel, yo, because they're going to talk about you in school the next day. And when them flyers come out, they're going to decide, there's so many parties. Which party do I go to?
Right.
Well, Cool Cow going to be over here. Oh, this one going to be over there. And they had to make up their mind. And you were trying to get as most parties as you could and try to develop a street rep, like, yo, these cats is hot. And when the emergence of the groups made it even more competitive. But I never had to organize a battle for money like that because it just didn't come my way. But you know, I've been challenged, or I heard I was challenged, but nobody ever got with me and said, well, let's do this. Because if they did, I would have been there and did my thing, got paid, and walked away smiling.
Okay, now let's move forward. We got about 5 or 7 minutes. I want to get into now records are coming out.
Right.
Recording contracts. How did that affect Kool Kyle, original Star Child?
Well, the deal with me was Flash, since I was like kind of close to Flash. Flash originally was on Enjoy Records, and I told him. I said, yo, I want to make a record. He was the second group on Enjoy. Okay, Funky Four was the first group. He was the second. Okay. I said, yo, I'm going to make a demo. I want you to bring it to Bobby or hook me up. He said, I got you. Simple as that. I got you. I went in, got the musicians, took them to the studio, paid them, wrote the song, wrote all the lyrics, co-produced myself with my drummer, Ronnie Sharrett, God bless the dead, and we made the demo. Had the demo in my hand, called a Flash, met Flash one night, went down to Enjoy Records, and I couldn't park the car because it was just it was on 125th Street back in those days. And with so much traffic, I couldn't find a parking space.
What was the name of the jam? What was the name of the jam?
Do You Like That Funky Beat?
Okay.
Okay? So I had the demo of it. Gave it to Flash. Flash went inside Enjoy Records. And by the time I found a place to park, which is like 2 blocks away, he comes out of Enjoy Records with a contract in his hand. He had papers, two papers. It was blowing in the wind. I'm like, yo, what is that? Where's my record? I'm looking for the white combo. Where's the, yo, what you do with the record? You left it there? He said, no, Bobby wants to sign you. And I got signed. Just like that. So Sugar Hill Gang had made their first record, and we knew that all of a sudden now it was about, yo, get the record done. Because if you get the record, you want your shows to do perform the record. And the money just exponentially just increased. Instead of getting $50 a place somewhere, now you're getting at least $500 to do something somewhere because now you're a recording artist. It sounds better. It looks better. And you're going out of state. Our thing was to get out of New York. Let's go somewhere. Let people see us. These records getting played on somebody's radio. We knew that. And that's exactly what had happened to me. My records didn't really kick off like they should have in New York, but I didn't know the science then, the politics then. There was a lot of that involved in it. Payola, who knew who and whatnot, blah, blah, blah. But I did travel. I went places. I played out of state a lot, man. And there was some places my records really did well. And I found out how well they did. How come they weren't doing well in New York, but they're doing well here? Because this one got paid to do that. This one did that. This one did this.
Wow.
And I made money. And it changed the whole aspect of the game. Because now rappers, now this term came about rappers. Okay, it always existed, but it was about following a format now. And you didn't have to do what you did as an MC. I'm an MC. And my whole thing is crowd control and rhymes and affected people. Now it's about writing songs now. And the whole aspect of the game changed. And it affected me like it made me just adjust my game, trying to write songs in a song format, which that developed a little bit later on, the whole 16-bar format, and breaks, the choruses, hooks, and all that. But in the beginning, it wasn't even like that. It was about imitating what we did out in the street, and that worked for a while. And it was enlightening. It was cool. It was something different, and you met famous stars and R&B artists because you did shows with them. You did interviews on the radio left and right. It just changed the whole aspect, and it made me appreciate more what the potential could have been or what it should have been, and I was really into it.
Okay, we got 2 minutes left.
My man.
I want to talk to you about and have you talk to people about what you're doing now as a true historian with my man and yours, Van Silk, and what that group is about and what Kool Kyle is doing now and what your plans are for the future.
Me and Van Silk, excellent promoter from back in the day, got together. We decided to try to correct some of the fallacies that are involved in the historic aspect of the pioneers. We came up with a title, True Historians, and we researched all the 5 boroughs in New York and the surrounding areas that claim to have been involved in hip-hop from the early days. We've collected over 5,000 flyers. We have an extensive collection. We've done extensive interviews with the pioneers from all over, not just New York, all over. And we're trying to document and correct the lies that have been told about us, some of them on purpose, some not, just to have a correct documentation of our history before we all leave this planet. And we're in the middle of it. We're doing very well. We also came up with a concept called When It Was Hip Hop, When It Was Hip Hop Music. We have a documentary coming out early next year. That contains everything about hip-hop that we consider valuable, that we feel the world needs to know about. Corrections, mm-hmm. again, about what was mistold and misled, getting our history correct. And what we're doing right now is getting that documentary together. We have a couple of radio shows. One of them is Hip Hop You Don't Stop, which was formerly your show. We do mm-hmm. open current interviews with not just hip-hop people, but stars that are relevant. We concentrate right. on the pioneers, some who really haven't gotten exposure that we feel they deserve. We deal with them.
Right.
When it was Hip-Hop Life and Lifestyles, our other radio show, and we deal with people who are hip-hop-oriented that have made it in other aspects of the industry, TV, movies, and they're a little bent on hip-hop. And what I'm doing musically, I'm in the studio right now with my man R.B. the Brolic. We get ready to come out with a Men vs. Many album. That's our group name, Men. A couple of very well-known producers the world does know about. I'm not going to mention their names now. I'm in the process mm-hmm. of doing that. There's a lot of things involved with Cool Child, the original Star Child, because, listen, it's not over. It's not over to the fat lady sings, and I don't know any fat ladies. I don't mess with fat ladies.
Where can people find you now on social media, Cool Kyle?
I'm on Facebook right now. Kyle Brinson is my real name because Facebook mm-hmm. makes you use a government. I'm Kyle Brinson. My email is coolcal76@gmail.com. You can find me at rapmania.com. That's Van Silk. Valerie Denise Jones, she's on Facebook and on Instagram. That's my publicist. And I think I left something out. I can't remember right now. I don't have it written down. But you can find me. Cool Cal, the original Star Child, and Kyle Brinson. Look for that. You can find me. You can get at me. You can call this Cool Cat if you want to bother him. He'll call me.
You know that. You know that. Let's give a shout out to Van Silk. All right.
No doubt. I'm here, Van Silk.
Hip hop MC Sha-Rock. I'm going to be reaching out to her because September we'll be honoring the Queens of Our Culture, and she's definitely
right.
one.
Shock Queen One, Queen One.
Right on. You know that. So, right now, though, we want to thank you, Cool Kyle, for your contributions, immense contributions to hip hop, the deep knowledge that you have that you've shared with us. And, you know, you got the support of Disco Daddy, Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop, from now until, my brother.
Likewise, my man, likewise. You know how we do. You know how we do.
You've been listening to Cool Kyle, the original Star Child, on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop.
So, wasn't it a great show? Come back next week, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Central Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop Show. Man, it's a great one. Epic, epic. See you next week. Bye.
Hey, what's going on? You know what I'm saying? This is Grab Lucaccia right now. You know what I'm saying? Mr. Clean Cut put together. Oh, man, you got to wait till you hear this, man. It's called Vibes Live number 3 theme song. Man, he got down and done it right, man. You know what I'm saying? Because I'm listening to it and I'm like, damn.
Oh, play that.
What the hell?
We over here breaking records of the year. Oh, yeah. Vibes Live, Robin Lynn, Maven. Got you playing again. Playing again. Win, win, win. Played every single day like, hey, hey. We over here and we doing it again. Popping for the top, DJ time to spin. Boss Live, character surprise, and the world vibes, stretch for that exercise.
Best Talk Radio of 2014.
Robin Lynn Maybin on the big screen.
The big screen.
West Music, Florida, representing Mad Capital Records, fingerprinting. Mad Capital Life indenting. Angel Sessions, gospel sensation. Talking all them blessings. Fly away with Tamika Trayvon. Now you've got to hear this. Hot up off the press, Vibes Live is out, is out. Sparking interest, Young Chi-Town,
Chi-Town.
Ike Ellis, Southeast 360 Music, and Jerry Royce Live. You got to hear this.
Hear this.
Willie Brown, and let's not forget about Freedom Doors and Ministry.
Freedom Doors and Ministry.
I am Vibes Live, two fingers up, Clean Cut Surprise.
No surprise, I do this for everybody, honest guys.
We over here breaking records of the year.
Oh, yeah.
Vibes Live, Robin Lynn, Maven. Got you playing again.
Playing again.
Wins and win, win. Gotta get you played every single day like, hey. We over here and we doing it again. Popping for the top, DJ time to spin. Boss Live, character surprise. And the world vibes, stretch for that exercise.
Yo, I step up and say step what's up. My name is Clean Cut. What as up? I throw my two fingers up, you say I'm so cool.
So
I
cool.
Got it, vibes live, so full.
So
everybody
cool.
Say I'm sitting on a stool and I'm spinning, but then I'm winning. And then I'm taking over swimming and pimping. But you know I ain't lynching. Keep it off the one time, forgot to mention. Keep it going, freestyle pension. Everybody got to get a piece. I keep it real up in the game and I'm smiling with my teeth. They looking so bright. I stopped the smoking,
stop
see.
The smoking,
I stopped
see.
The drinking,
stop
see.
The drinking,
but I'm
see.
Sober, see.
Sober,
I keep
see.
It real up in the game. They call me OG.
OG.
OG gets crazy when I'm lyrically up in the game. Got you feeling like insanity. Got you over, now you wanna see me triple X to B. Everybody wanna come and try to beat me.
We over here breaking records of the year.
I said it here, hot, you just don't stop it, and just get ready to jam. The Disco Daddy Wide World of Hip Hop Radio Show, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, only on VibeLive.com, with special guests every week. Don't miss it.
Hello out there, Disco Daddy here. Welcome to another edition of Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. Today, one of our special guests, Charlie Prince, very prolific hip-hop artist. He's probably best known, and we're going to get into this, for a hip-hop anthem which everybody knows, but very few people know who wrote it. The Roof, The Roof, The Roof is on fire for this man. Along with his group, the Dynamic Three, came out with this record back in the 70s. It probably added fire to what was already a hot, hot new commodity, hip-hop. Tim Charlie Prince on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip-Hop. How you doing today, my brother?
Oh, everything is good so far. Maintaining.
Okay, so. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. We want to get into your story. And as you describe it to us, as you start back in the early years of your life and how you fell into hip-hop or got into it consciously, just give us some of the flavor also of what was happening around you at the time. You know, the Park Jams, a lot of people who don't live in New York may have heard of Park Jams, but they may not know exactly what it was and exactly how important they were to the building of the foundation of hip-hop. So King Charlie Prince. You got the mic, starting with your early life.
Well, it all started out, I was a crate carrier. I used to carry crates for a brother named DJ Cool D. He was like my mentor when it came to, doing music. He was a DJ, and during that time, I used to, I used to be behind the ropes, not behind the ropes, but outside the ropes. And I used to see all
okay,
those
what period are we talking about, and how old were you then? What period did you
I say, let me see, in 79 to 80. And
okay.
When I used,
just
when
as I records were started to be made in
right.
hip-hop.
And
okay.
I started out watching him outside the ropes DJing, and I used to see all these other cats behind the ropes, on a mic. Saying yes, yes, y'all, 1-2, 1-2, and all of this. So I'm like, wow, I want to do that. So I,
wow, yeah.
So I made myself available as a crate carrier just because I wanted to find out where this brother lived, and come to find out he was living in the next building from me. So I carried the crates up to his house, and I saw all these speakers he had up in there, all these crates of records and albums. So while he was putting stuff away, he let me get on his turntables and play with it a little bit. So, because I started out DJing first. And so I used to.
This the Bronx?
Yeah. And I used to be mixing a little bit. So after that, it kind of got a little boring to me doing the mixing and stuff. So what made me really get into the hip hop is the brother next door from me named MBG. We was enemies at one time because because his sister didn't like me for some apparent reason. But one day he just knocked on my door and asked me, did I want to do a show in New Haven, Connecticut? And I'm like, why is this guy asking me this? But I said, okay. But because I was bad in school, my mother didn't approve of it until I told her it was from the dude next door. He was a good guy. You know, all the parents liked him. So when she found out it was from him, she said, okay, you can go. So we went to New Haven, Connecticut. But before we went to New Haven, Connecticut, I found out that he asked another brother named Rick, who was my other partner. Mm-hmm. Now, me and him had a beef in school because we used to go to the same school. And then Rick found out I was going, so he was like, yo, I don't want him to go. But Greg took it anyway, MBG, you know. But the funny thing is, after all of that, we went through with him, with me and Rick, after we did the show in New Haven, Connecticut, we don't forget about all of that when we was going through. You know, because we saw we was rocking the crowd, and it was you know what I'm saying? This was during the time. Now, MBG, at the time, he wasn't down with us as a rapper. He was just like, he was just a relative of the family that we was doing this work for, you see? And then when we got back, after we finished rocking Connecticut, New Haven, we came back. We was like the Temptations trying to figure out a name of the group. We was running around like, what we going to call ourselves? Yeah. And then we started out with Devilish 3. Because when we was in New Haven, they didn't have a name. The people was calling it Charlie D and the crew, because back then I was called Charlie D. So they used to call it Charlie D and the crew. But then when we got back to New York, we was trying to figure out a name. So we started out with the Devilish 3. And then we went into this MC battle because there used to be a Your Spot across the street from our building called, it was a Burger King at one time, but then they turned it into a club. So we went over there and entered into a battle with some other cats, and it was a couple of groups, and Rockmaster Scott, he was a DJ for another group. And so my DJ, we didn't have a DJ that was actually on point with us. He was just with us because we knew him. That was the dude that taught me the DJ mixing Cool D. So when we did the battle, we beat everybody. So the DJ we had at the time, he wasn't available all the time. So Scott met us the next day on, you know, across the street. We set up a meeting where we can come together as a group. Because he left his group and came with us. So after he came with us, then we started practicing with our routines and stuff, because we used to listen to Cold Crush, how they used to sing their little routines back then, and we used to listen to Fantastic Five. So we started picking out songs and making lyrics out of it. So we started entering places like the T-Connection and the Underground, the Ecstasy Garage and Sparkle and all them places back then. We started fitting in with everybody, Harlem World and everything. And then the guy that owned the club across the street from us, one day he asked us, did we want to make a record? We said, a record? Wow. We were like, yeah. So
yeah, let me interrupt you just for a second.
Okay.
You started just as records and recording contracts were being made, were given out. But maybe a year or so before, everybody's doing that for just the love of what hip hop was.
Right.
The parties and
we were just doing it in the box, you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
How did that change the game when, in your instance, people started giving out? You're no longer doing this for fun. Now you can obviously get a record if you get the attention of somebody. So this guy reaching out to you like this, what impact did that have on y'all as a group?
Man, when he set a record, it was like, okay, fine, we was down. But it took a year. So we just thought, at that time, we thought we were just messing with our head. Until one day he called us. He called us on our phones, and he told us to meet him at Unique Recording Studio. We said, so we got the address. And we went down to Unique Recording Studio, but we didn't have no song. So he said, I hope y'all have a song. So we was on the train going down. So I wrote a song real quick called It's Life. You gotta think twice. I don't know if you remember that song, It's Life. You gotta think twice. And we wrote that song on the way down. And then when we got there, of course, we was reading off the paper and everything because we didn't know it by heart. I wrote everybody's part. And then we got in the booth. We did our part. And then, of course, we had to come back because he said we wasn't saying it the way we felt it because we were still reading on it. You know what I'm saying? So we got a copy of a cassette tape, took it home, practiced it. Then it was time to go back in there again. And this was during the time when WizKid, may he rest in peace, was alive. You know, because he the one that did the he did the music for us. And so then we got back down there. It was on a Unique Recording Studio. And then we recorded It's Life. You got to think twice. And the next thing you know, I say a couple of months, the guy, the producer, he pulled up on the block. And he opened up the trunk. And we saw all these records. he gave us 10 apiece. And we ran with it. We were so happy. We couldn't even believe it. And so after maybe 2 weeks more later on, we started hearing it on WBLS. I think he was playing it. I forgot the DJ that was playing it, but he was playing it. It was like an every morning song. And I don't know if you ever seen Five Heartbeats. When they heard their song on the radio, we were so excited and happy. And we said,
I've been there too, my brother.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I do know. It's very few people experience that feeling, even if they get into the business, because, you know, a lot of records are brought to radio stations and never played.
Exactly.
So you're one of a select member of a very select club. Although there are hundreds of artists recording out there, very few have actually heard their songs coming out the radio.
And
Charlie Priest on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. Go ahead, Charlie.
And when they was playing, it was on a regular rotation for a good while. But the only thing that knocked our song out the box, out that rotation, was Sucker MCs. Whether when Sucker MCs came out with Run DMC.
That's how I remember it.
All of a sudden, because it came out during the same time on Profile Records, and all of a sudden, we started hearing Sucker MCs, and our joint got kicked off the rotation, so... we still was doing shows like in Broadway International and things like that. But everything slowed down for us until one day the producer asked us, he wanted us to do another song. So that's when we did Request Line. Now, that was in 84. We did Request Line.
Wow.
I wrote the parts for everybody. And once we knocked that out, we didn't have a B-side. So the guy came up with The Roof Is On Fire. So I'm sitting there like, okay. I wrote all the lyrics to the song, but The Roof Is On Fire was set at the end of the song. So it really never had a hook. You know what I'm saying? Never really had a hook to the song.
Wow, yeah.
And this is why a lot of people got caught up, because they thought it was just a saying. You know what I'm saying? They never heard it like a hook. So everybody just started using it and using it. And then they found out that we were the owners of it. So so that's how people didn't know who we was, because they had heard Bloodhound Gang. They heard it used it, Head of State. It was in so many movies, 8 Mile. It was in Steve Harvey Show. I'm like, okay. And so I'm like, okay, that's cool. And, you know, during that time, I thought, you know, if they only use it one time, you get paid. But I realized that when it's constantly played on the air in other countries as well, on TV shows, we get paid too. So I'm like, I like that. Because, you know, when I was growing up back in the days, I used to hate seeing repeats. You know what I'm saying? So today, I don't mind seeing repeats as long as my song is in it. You know what I'm saying?
Let's touch on this for a second.
Okay.
Copyright. Protecting your creation. Now, what did you guys learn about recording the songs? Obviously, Roof Is On Fire. You're hearing it in any party that you walk into. But the legal part of it, what do you advise young artists to do to protect themselves? What have you learned in the business about that?
One, if you don't understand it, ask questions. And if they try to explain the contract using big terminology, you tell them to break it down to the latest terms so that you can understand, like ABC and 1, 2, 3. You want to learn it like that so that when you do sign sign that contract, you know exactly what you're signing for, because contracts is designed where the one who give you the contract come out on top. You know, it's always going to be like that. So this is why you have to make sure it's equal. You want full disclosure, equal consideration. You want all of that. You understand? And you got to make sure that you don't sign your publishing away. You know? And if you're an artist, copyright your name. Own it.
Okay, that's knowledge right there, and that's one of the reasons we do this show. Now, King Charlie Prince, you're cooking and smoking in 1985, one of the hot acts out there. And basically, where do you go from there? You put your Dynamic 3. What happened?
Well, I'm still doing my thing. And when it comes to the group, we still hang out like brothers. I mean, we all in different states now. I'm in New York, Virginia. My other partner's in Delaware. The other one's in Charlotte. The other one's in New Jersey. But we stay in communication. You know what I'm saying? And we'll come together if it's a big event. But if it's something small, we'll talk about, we'll tell each other about it and keep it like that. But when it comes to like awards and things like that, we're going to show up.
Okay. Now, during the period that you started as a crate carrier, what were the influences? Who was out there actually? What groups, what individuals were around you while you were carrying crates that actually had an influence on you?
Well, the one who had an influence on me was this brother named DJ Cool D. He was a neighborhood DJ, but he had some type of connection with Cold Crush and all of them, because he hung out with the big boys at the time. So he knew them and they knew him. But as far as other than that, it was really Cold Crush and Fantastic. You know, during that time growing up, I couldn't even hang out at parties. I used to hear about them, but my moms didn't let me go because she used to be nervous, you know. But I would tell you what I used to do, though. I ain't gonna front though, but I used to bite rhymes now. Back in the
early days,
when I was in school, we used to have battles, and I used to be biting people rhymes, like who was it? Raheem. I took some of his rhymes. I took somebody from the Funky Four. It was Rodney C. And I used to like these rhymes, you know. So I used to just make them look like I made them up. Until somebody heard the tape.
Well, see, it's good to be able to admit that, you know what I'm saying? Back in the day, it was probably normal for people to do that, you know?
Yeah, because, you know, they said some good rhymes. I used to want to fit in, you know, so I did that, you know?
How important do you think? Go ahead. What I was asking is, how important do you think was the use of mixtapes in spreading the popularity of many of the groups just before records were made?
Wait. Break that down again.
Because mixtapes, in other words, like the pause tapes people used to make, I don't know if that was a period while you were still carrying crates before your group came out, but I know after records came out, tapes were not, before records, the tapes were tapes of shows, artists and shows, doing shows like at the clubs and stuff. It wasn't actually the mixtape because they didn't have records then.
Right.
But after records came out, am I accurate in that assessment, that after records came out, then you started getting the two mixtapes?
Absolutely. That's when the mixtapes came out back then, but when they was doing it in the parks and stuff and, like, at clubs, you know, like when Cold Crush and Fantastic used to have the battles and Busy Bee stuff, you know, used to battle Kumu B and things like that, they used to have this store and may he rest in peace, his name was Richard T. He owned the T Connection up in the Bronx. You know, he used to sell these cassette tapes, and people used to buy them tapes like crazy because they wanted to hear, you know, how they sound. They wanted, if they missed the show, they wanted to hear it. You know, those mixtapes, those are classics, man.
Man, now see, that's something that very few people actually know about, and that's why we have people like you on this show, because the knowledge you drop, you guys go up in New York, you chop this up, you know all this back and forth. When you step outside of New York City, everything you say is a revelation to people. And it illuminates a portion of the song of hip-hop when very few people actually wasn't even called hip-hop. You see what I'm saying? It was a moment before records. And you come in just as records, that's why it's very, your perspective is very interesting, King Charlie Prince. Now, today's artist, first of all, I know that you were part of a group of everybody else who back then felt, well, this is not going to be around for a while, but maybe you weren't. What was the feeling among you, your group, and the people about hip-hop as a new music form at the time? When you got into it, were you thinking you're part of something brand new that's going to be here for, you know, years and years, or was it something like, well, let's get on this before it fades away? What was that like?
You know, when we first did this thing, it was like, it's Life We Gotta Think Twice. It kind of like only went in the tri-state area, so I kind of figured that it wasn't going to last too long. But then when we did Questline and The Roof Was on Fire, and I did this big first concert, it was like, it was in Fayetteville, North Carolina. When I walked out on the stage, I didn't even have to do nothing. The people were just screaming, and I was like, God damn. I said, damn, I'm like Michael Jackson out here. It's like I could just put my hand up and control the crowd. I was loving that feeling, you know what I'm saying? another funny thing is because when The Roof Was on Fire came out, and my mom, she had a Christian girlfriend, and she was so happy, she went and took it to her girlfriend's house. She didn't know it had a cuss at the end. and she came back. She said, "Why you didn't tell me y'all was cussing at the end?" I said, "Mom, you just ran out of the house."
That's funny. Oh boy, that's funny.
She felt so messed up by that one. Yeah, but after that, we just started doing shows with all these different artists. I mean, it was like, I didn't think hip-hop was leaving after that. I said, wow, it's going to be here for a good long time. And it stayed, last, but unfortunately, the business people got involved and changed it up.
There you go. That's one of the points that I wanted to make. The beginning of records changed the game. In more ways than one. No longer were the hearts and souls of these people into the new music for the fun of it. Now everybody wants to get a recording contract. So you get a lot of groups who, some groups were offered and some started to slide back on the wayside, and you never hear of them again. But we're glad that you're still around, King Charlie Prince, to tell us your story. And to still contributing to hip hop. Now, where can people find your music for purchase, my brother, on the internet?
iTunes, Amazon, Spotify, Tidal, TuneCore, all of Apple. It's on all the sites, you know. So, and I try to keep it going. I have a new album coming out now called Still Standing. You know, and I got a couple of features that's going to be on it. And hopefully they're on time to lay their vocals down because I'm the type of person, like, if you take too long, I'm going to write a verse just in case. You know what I'm saying? I always do that. It's in my blood to do this, you know? And I don't have time for people sitting there saying, all right, I couldn't make it today. You know, I got to move on. And if I lay my and if I lay the whole track out, I redo it when they're ready, and then put them on it, and take one of my verses off, you know. But I'll keep it just like it is. It'll just be
Are you producing any other artists?
Not yet. Nah, because I don't really want to do that because the artists today, they think things are supposed to happen overnight. And that's not how it works. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
And they're not patient like that. So I don't want to sit there and say this and say that, and then they're looking for this and looking for that. So, you know.
Okay. King Charlie Prince, Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop, want to thank you for your contribution to hip hop, sir. And for thank you for doing my show. The roof is on fire. This is the man who wrote those lyrics, who wrote that song, King Charlie Prince.
All right.
We want you to know that we dearly appreciate your contribution to hip hop. That's one of the hip hop standards. And people sing it every day and have no idea who wrote that. Hopefully now there'll be more people being made aware of King Charlie Prince. Get on the internet, find your music, and you can still make a little change, my brother. Okay?
All right.
All right. We love you. King Charlie Prince, you've been listening to Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. Peace.
So wasn't it a great show? Come back next week, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Central Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop Show. Man, it's a great one. Epic. See you next week. Bye.